One of the secrets of holiness that had a powerful impact on Catholicism in Indiana can be found in the life and ministry of our first bishop, Simon Brute. He was intellectually gifted, one of the first significant theologians to guide the leadership of the church in the United States. He had been a restless soul through the years of his vocational discernment, and continued to struggle during his years of teaching in the United States. He wrestled with a desire to become a missionary in the Far East. The case can be made that he found peace of soul after he became the founding missionary bishop of the territory that encompassed Indiana and eastern Illinois. For the 2005 summer series of my reflections, I plan to focus on the life and ministry of our first bishop. He was born March 20, 1779, and died June 26, 1839. Elements of his life and ministry can serve as a framework for reflections on the meaning of his virtues for us Catholics some 160 years later. I truly believe he is a blessing and a grace for our local church. Many of you are aware that because of this conviction, I have initiated the beginning stages of the cause for the canonization of Bishop Brute. You also know that I named our seminary House of Formation at Marian College under his patronage. I hope to frame my reflections around the stages of our founding bishop's life. Tentatively, I see the reflections for the series unfolding as follows. The first, about a childhood shaped by life during the French Revolution. Gabriel Simon Brute was born in affluence, but even as a child was forced to live his Catholic faith with extraordinary discretion. The second reflection, Gabriel Simon's academic and medical background. He was an outstanding student and became a distinguished medical doctor. Thirdly, vocation to the priesthood and missionary aspirations. Only later did Gabriel Simon Brute de Remours discern a vocation to priesthood, and that in spite of his mother's strong and vociferous objections. The fourth reflection, missionary to the United States, his priestly ministry in Maryland. Father Brute wrestled with the desire to be a missionary to the Far East, like St. Francis Xavier, but as a Sulpician priest, he was sent to the United States instead. The focus of his ministry was that of theologian and teacher. The fifth reflection will be about his ministry at Emmitsburg, Maryland. During his sojourn at Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg, the spirituality and holiness of Father Brute caught the attention of Elizabeth Ann Seton, who has been canonized for her holiness and charity. Father Brute had become her spiritual director. The sixth reflection, about a pastor at heart. While he was highly respected as a theologian by the first bishops of the United States, Father Brute was sought out for his sacramental ministry, his pastoral wisdom, and for spiritual direction. The seventh reflection, on the status of the church in Indiana in 1834. Of the roughly 1 million people living in Indiana and Illinois, there were an estimated 25,000 Catholics spread over the large territory. Chicago had the largest number. Conditions were primitive. The Ohio and Wabash rivers were main arteries for travel. The first missionaries, however, traversed most of the territory by horseback. The eighth reflection, Bishop of Vincennes, 1834. Against his protestations and efforts to refuse his appointment as Bishop of Vincennes, because of what he considered severe pastoral, spiritual, and physical limitations, Simon Brûté was named to Vincennes in 1834. He had only two priests, and one on loan, to help found the diocese. The ninth reflection, 5 years of effective ministry. As we will see, our first missionary bishop found peace of soul and accomplished extraordinary results in ministry in 5 short years. A tenth reflection will be on the poverty and holiness of Bishop Brûté. A friend of his, Bishop Flaget of Bardstown, said, and I quote, "An American missionary had to be able to live on nothing and cook it himself," unquote. An 11th reflection is on the illness and death of a simple bishop. Bishop Brûté was buried in borrowed clothes. His last words were those of Jesus on the cross, "Sitio, I thirst." Finally, I will do a reflection on the process for the cause of canonization. On December 4, 1891, while visiting Vincennes, Cardinal Gibbons said, and I quote, "Worthy citizens of Vincennes, you need not go on pilgrimages to visit the tombs of saints. There is one reposing here in your midst, namely the saintly founder of this diocese, Right Reverend Simon Brûté," close quotes. My sources for reflecting on the life of Bishop Brûté will be that of Simon Brûté de Remour by Sister Mary Silesia Godecker, a Benedictine, who published his life by St. Meinrad Historical Essays at St. Meinrad in 1931. The second source is entitled The Reed and the Rock, Portrait of Simon Brûté by Theodore Maynard. It was published by Longmans, Green & Company in New York in 1942. The third source, Frontier Bishop, The Life of Bishop Simon Brûté by James Roosevelt Bailey, edited by Albert J. Nevins, a Maryknoll missionary, and published by our Sunday Visitor in 1971. Bishop of Indiana, Simon William Gabriel Brûté de Remour, was born in Rennes, the capital of the province of Brittany in France, on the night of March 20th, 1779. He was baptized the next morning in the parish church of Saint Germain. Both his mother and father were in their second marriage, having lost their respective spouses, their first spouses, in death. His father had 7 children by his first wife. Simon and Brother Augustine were born of their parents' second marriage. Simon once wrote that as a child his mother said, "You were born to live in affluence." Her family had inherited the title printer to the king and parliament. His father was superintendent of the finances of the royal domains in Brittany. The Brûtés lived in an apartment wing of the Palace of Justice in Rennes. Their affluence was short-lived, however. In 1786, when Simon was 7, his father died suddenly after major surgery that was required by a fall from his horse. At his death, it was discovered that his finances were in disarray because he had lent large uncollected sums of money to friends. Simon's mother was challenged to provide for her two sons. She taught them the faith, discipline, and hard work. Simon was only 10 when the Bastille was stormed, only 12 when the French king and queen were caught in flight. The Constituent Assembly had decreed the civil constitution of the clergy, which put the French Revolution into opposition to the church. Indeed, the intent was to de-Catholicize France. The French Revolution had a profound influence on the early years of Simon. His mother, a woman of strong Catholic faith, sheltered two priests in their apartment at great risk. She erected a secret altar where the priests could celebrate daily Mass, attended by her and her sons Simon and Augustine. When the priests had to seek shelter elsewhere, Madame Brute gathered Catholic friends for prayer without a priest on Sunday mornings. From an early age, Simon was given to sketching places with accompanying notes to keep his memories alive. One sketch illustrates the impact of the French Revolution on Simon Brute. It was a sketch of the Cathedral of Rennes, formerly the Benedictine Abbey Church of St. Melanie, and the Abbey, founded by St. Melanie, an early bishop of Rennes. Simon wrote of his early memory of the Benedictines of the Abbey, where he had attended liturgical services in 1787 and 1788. He wrote that in 1791 the church and the abbey were usurped by the revolutionary clergy. In 1792, they became the prison of the Catholic clergy who remained faithful to their vows and would not take the new oath. He wrote, "I visited them twice while they were confined there. I was disguised as a baker's boy, a big bread basket on my head." In 1793, the church was turned into a stable for the cavalry. In 1795, into the city hospital. According to other reports, as a boy, on numerous occasions, Simon carried the Eucharist to the imprisoned priests. On one occasion, he carried the Eucharist, accompanied by a priest who posed as a baker. Due to the poor prison conditions, the prison guards welcomed those bringing food for the prisoners. Simon carried the Eucharist. The priest baker heard the confessions of the imprisoned clergy. Simon's visitation of the imprisoned clergy was at the risk of his life. His early education began before the impact of the revolution was felt in Rennes. Subsequently, it was largely accomplished by private tutoring from priests who were in hiding. All the while, Simon was working in his mother's printing business. He also continued to go to confession and receive communion from a priest who was in hiding. With the fall of Robespierre in the summer of 1794, the worst of the terror of the French Revolution began to fade. Rather than being executed, priests were given life in prison or deported. Simon himself began to think of a profession. He decided that he was not a printer. He discerned that he wanted to pursue a career in medicine. Initially, his study of medicine could be pursued in Rennes, where Simon became the apprentice of a local Catholic practitioner, Dr. Duval. In an era when strict requirements for the practice of medicine did not yet exist, Simon read the books on the doctor's shelves and accompanied his mentor when he visited patients. In those days, a physician had to be his own pharmacist as well. After 2 years, Simon would pursue his medical career in Paris. Madame Brute's insistent Catholic faith and courage in the face of possible persecution had a profound effect on her son Simon. His emerging strength of character, strong personal faith, and conscious concern for imprisoned clergy mirrored that of his mother. At age 20, the future founding bishop of the Catholic Church in Indiana moved from Rennes, the capital of Brittany in France, to Paris. It was a great change for Simon Brute as he pursued his medical career. His mother had hopes that her son would become a great, indeed a famous surgeon. If that were to happen, Simon had to attend the best medical school in France. Madame Brute was well aware that Paris had been the center of revolutionary frenzy. Aware that the great city was a center of licentiousness, in characteristic fashion she wrote out a set of rules to be observed by Simon. Along with instruction for maintaining good health, Simon was advised not to become too involved in social affairs and to fall among bad company. He was dissuaded from attending the theater. On the positive side, she encouraged her son to practice his religious duties, to find a confessor, to read the Bible and the works of St. Francis de Sales. As for medical studies, a few subjects thoroughly mastered were better than many pursued superficially. In its day, the College of Medicine in Paris was considered the finest in the world. At least four of Brute's professors would find a permanent place in medical history for contributions in the humane treatment of the insane, also in the field of chemistry, in the study of anatomy, and of surgery. Madame Brute's concern for Simon's spiritual and religious values was well placed. In the post-revolution era, it was not uncommon for professors to consider that it was incumbent upon them as scientists and philosophers to disparage religion and the so-called superstitions of the Catholic faith. Many of the young, intelligent medical students readily mirrored the mind of some of their faculty members. The cynicism and religious skepticism, however, was not embraced by all the medical students. Simon Brute and some of his student friends formed a religious sodality, and they found a priest moderator to help them. Later, Simon would write that the preservation of his faith in Paris could be credited to the influence of this priest moderator and to his association with like-minded peers. He and his peers chose topics for their written thesis that gave them the opportunity to affirm their Catholic faith. Apparently, the controversy of the medical school caught the attention of the first consul of France, Napoleon Bonaparte. While his motives were not clear, he is reported to have instructed the professors of the medical college to adhere strictly to the topics of their curriculum and to avoid criticism of religion. During this period of medical studies, Simon's characteristic concern for a colleague who was unfairly imprisoned for taking care of the medical needs of an alleged conspirator led him to intercede for his friend's pardon. His intervention caught the attention of Bonaparte. Simon was also credited with finding a group of disguised priests to be available to provide absolution at the scaffold for a Catholic prisoner who was condemned to the guillotine. Simon Brute emerged as a brilliant medical student. In 1802, just before he graduated, he won the coveted Corvisart Prize, awarded to the most outstanding medical student. The competition was open to all of the 1,100 students of the medical college, and the prize was determined in a process of written and oral examinations. Winning this prize guaranteed Simon Brute a successful medical career as a doctor in France. In fact, although he did not seek it, after his first internship, Simon was appointed physician to the first dispensary, the major medical center in Paris. The appointment had the fingerprints of Napoleon Bonaparte on it. It seemed that it would only be a matter of time before Simon Brute would win a position on the faculty of the College of Medicine. Simon Brute, however, refused the government appointment. His mother was stunned. To everyone's astonishment, Simon had decided that he wanted to enter the priesthood. He had persevered in his medical studies, and he did so with honor and distinction. As a gesture of gratitude, he sent the Corvisart Prize to his first teacher and mentor in Rennes, Dr. Duval. Madame Brute had no idea that her son had been discerning a vocation to the priesthood. Eventually, he would try to convince her that if it was noble to become a doctor who cured illness of the body, it was even nobler to cure the illnesses of the soul. His mother was not convinced and vehemently opposed his decision to become a priest. She had wisely counseled him to take measures to protect and nurture his Catholic faith in the culture of Paris after the French Revolution. She had worried about the anti-religious environment, not realizing that perhaps her own strong influence would unwittingly lead her son to pursue studies for the Catholic priesthood. When the future Bishop of Vincennes, medical doctor Simon Brute, decided he was being called by God to become a priest, his mother vehemently opposed the idea. So did some of his friends. After all, he was a distinguished member of the medical profession in France. His mother, for practical reasons as well, wanted him to assist in financing the medical study of his brother Augustine. Eventually, he was able to convince his mother that he needed to respond to a different calling, and he headed back to Paris at the same time that Augustine entered the College of Medicine. In November of 1803, Simon began private seminary studies. For 10 years, during the French Revolution, houses of religious formation and seminaries had been closed. The shortage of faithful clergy was severe, and young candidates for the priesthood were responding to the need for ministry of those folks who had remained faithful. Diocesan seminaries were reopened by bishops, and in October of 1804, Simon entered the seminary of Saint-Sulpice in Paris. At this time, he came into contact with the Superior General of the Society of Saint-Sulpice, Jacques-André Emery, one of the stalwart religious leaders throughout the Revolution, even while he was imprisoned and was under the threat of the guillotine. Simon's connection to Father Emery would chart the course of his future. The Superior General had already communicated to the first Bishop of the United States, John Carroll of Baltimore, that he was willing to send priests to America to start a seminary. A future seminary professor began his own seminary studies unaware of the commitment of Bishop England. With a scholar's pension, Simon Brute began studying philosophy and theology. Natural scholar though he was, a nephew would quote him as saying, "I did not come to the seminary to be a scholar, but to be a saint." At 25 years of age, the new seminarian was older than his peers. In fact, most seminarians were being ordained at his age. Simon Brute also differed from other candidates for the priesthood in that he was a medical doctor. The tie to Napoleon Bonaparte appeared at this time, reappeared really. About to be crowned as emperor, Bonaparte appointed Brute master of ceremonies for the Cardinal Archbishop of Paris. While Simon did not seek advancement, the appointment provided a stipend which he could contribute to the payment of his brother Augustine's medical education. During his seminary career, committed student that he was, Simon Brute began building a library for which he would become noted in his future ministry in the United States. In fact, the collection of books would be the only thing he really ever owned. Madame Brute's opposition to her son's vocation to the priesthood resurfaced during his seminary years. Several times during this period, she tried to intercede with Father Emery to intervene with her son. She could not be deflected from her conviction that he would be an excellent physician, and that was his destiny. The Sulpician General Superior agreed that Simon would make an excellent physician, but he reminded her that in no walk of life could he be of more service than in the priesthood. She conceded the point, but to hope that perhaps he would find an appointment that would allow his medical talent to flourish. Meanwhile, Simon Brute was wrestling with vocational concerns of a different sort. He became preoccupied with the desire to become a foreign missionary in India. As such, his medical credentials could be a valuable asset. He also struggled with the possibility of becoming a Sulpician priest. Finally, on June 10, 1808, the day before the Feast of the Holy Trinity, he was ordained a priest. And he joined the Sulpicians after ordination, and he was loaned to the Diocese of Rennes to teach in the seminary there. Just after his ordination, Napoleon offered Father Brute an appointment to the Imperial Chapel. Simon refused the appointment, and once more his mother's ambition for her priest's son was thwarted. Father Simon's Sulpician superior, Father Emery, was concerned with the new priest's zeal that apparently appeared excessive at times. He counseled Father Brute to be prudent in his early ministry. Not surprisingly, the desire to be a missionary continued to weigh on Father Brute. Two facts from this period of our first bishop's life are familiar in our day as well. It is not uncommon for parents to discourage a son from pursuing a vocation to the priesthood, and for reasons that are similar to those of Madame Brute. Yet there is no greater opportunity to touch the deepest meaning of people's lives than through ministry in the priesthood. Secondly, the zeal of new priests is refreshing and keeps our church young in our day too. Yet the wisdom of the older Sulpician superior helps on the way to holiness as well. The future bishop of Vincennes had become a Sulpician priest, and the mission of the Sulpician priests was to prepare candidates for the priesthood. His first assignment was to teach in the seminary in Rennes, in Lombardy, in France. By all accounts, Father Brute was an effective teacher. Yet the young priest began to dream of being a missionary in India or China. In fact, he did receive a call to become a missionary, not to the Orient, but to the New World. At this point, Father Simon Brute's life intersected with that of another pioneer missionary in America. Father Benedict Joseph Flaget, the newly named Bishop of Bardstown in Kentucky, had come to Paris to plead with his Sulpician superior to intervene against his being made a bishop, to no effect. Father Brute met him there. In his early missionary life, Father Flaget had been sent to Vincennes for several years. A military post had been established there in the early 1700s, and by the middle of that century, a church had been built. It was described as built of logs set upright and roofed with thatch covered with adobe. Parish records date from 1749. During the American Revolution, George Rogers Clark had captured Vincennes and won the entire Old Northwest. Father Gibault was a missionary companion to Colonel Clark. Father Flaget was sent to replace Father Gibault in Vincennes after Indiana had been without a priest for 3 years. The old church was falling into ruins and there was severe poverty. Eventually, Father Flaget was recalled to serve in the East. Father Brute was fascinated by the stories Bishop-elect Flaget told of his missionary adventures in America. Bishop Flaget would become his friend, and he encouraged him to go to the missions in America. Father Brute wrote to two friends of his, quote, "Read low and alone, and alone. It is at this moment that I have need of my friends before the Lord. I depart for the American missions. My spiritual directors have been unanimous in their opinion. The bishop consented with a readiness that confirmed me in the hope that it is a call from Providence. Mother did not resist. Her sacrifice is complete." Close quotations. On June 10, 1810, in the company of Bishop-elect Flaget, he sailed for America. Once he reached the New World, Father Brute found that he would not be a missionary in the way he had hoped. Once again, he was assigned by his Sulpician superiors to teach. The Sulpicians had founded a college and a seminary in Baltimore, and they assumed responsibility for another college in Emmitsburg. Someone with Father Brute's education and talent was sorely needed. He was assigned to teach moral philosophy. Father Brute encountered two difficulties. First of all, he was without his beloved books, his substantial library, which was still in France. And he found it extremely difficult to learn English. He wrote to Bishop Flaget, and I quote, "I am trying to learn practically my English. I have said Mass and preached, bad preaching as it may be, in 6 different places. This must force this dreadful English into my backward head, or I must renounce forever to know it." Unquote. He would develop his ability to write in English, but he would never become fluent in conversation. For one thing, Father Brute was sure he would stay in America until he resolved his quest to go to the foreign missions. Once more he found himself longing to go to India or China. He even wrote to his superiors in France asking that he might be sent there, all the while knowing that the Orient was beyond the mission of the Sulpicians. In response, he wrote again to his superiors and said, "Our America is suffering too." And he urged that more priests be sent to the missions in the New World. And so he continued to teach in Baltimore, even as he would struggle with the idea of going to India or China for years to come. Earlier in 1791, escaping the French Revolution, a young priest, Father Jean Dubois, fled to America, where eventually he founded a school that would come to be known as Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg, in Maryland. Eventually, responsibility for the college was accepted by the Sulpicians, and after 2 years in Baltimore, Father Brute was assigned there to help Father Dubois. The beginning phase of Father Simon Brute's missionary life in the New World found his obedience tested by his confinement to teaching future missionaries for America. His dreams of foreign missions continued to test his fidelity. In addition to uncertainty, he also struggled with the challenge of learning English. Our first bishop's obedience and his perseverance in the face of difficulty and disappointment are a valuable example and encouragement for us to trust in Providence. And let us note, his mother's sacrifice was complete. Until he became the Bishop of Vincennes, Father Simon Brute spent most of his priestly life at Mount St. Mary's Seminary and College in Emmitsburg, Maryland. In 1808, Father Jean Dubois opened a minor seminary at Emmitsburg, the start of what would come to be called the Mountain or Mount. He envisioned the minor seminary at Mount St. Mary as a feeder to the major seminary in Baltimore. The Mount was sponsored by the Society of Saint-Sulpice until eventually it would become an independent major seminary and college. Father Dubois, later Bishop of New York, became the patron of Elizabeth Ann Seton and her companion Sisters of Charity, a community in its infancy, following the charism of the Daughters of Charity. When they moved from Baltimore, their first home in Emmitsburg was the log cabin that belonged to Father Dubois. Minor seminarians assisted in the settlement of the sisters. Father Simon Brute was assigned to Mount St. Mary's Seminary in the fall of 1812. He and Elizabeth Ann Seton became acquainted, and almost immediately they sensed a spiritual kinship that would develop into a storied spiritual relationship. She taught Simon English as he continued to struggle with the language of the New World. He in turn became the spiritual director of the future St. Elizabeth Ann Seton and chaplain to her community of sisters. On her deathbed, she bequeathed her Holy Bible with her marginal notations to Simon. He used it in teaching scripture to the seminarians. The Bible now resides at the old cathedral in Vincennes. Father Brute became a revered presence at the Mount. He was an effective teacher of the sacred sciences to the seminarians. Because of the circumstances and developing culture in America, he had deep convictions about the need of solid philosophical and theological formation for the future priests. He was considered an exemplary priest, noted for his holiness and for his pastoral dedication as well as his theological expertise. His austerity was considered both edifying and at times eccentric. In addition to a full teaching schedule, he was much sought after to hear confessions and to bring the Eucharist to the homebound and elderly in and around the environs of Emmitsburg, mostly going on foot. He commented how wonderful the day of a priest. He was a frequent contributor to the infancy of Catholic newspapers on the East Coast. In 1815, Simon returned to France to visit his elderly mother. She was failing, but was under the good care of his brother Augustine, who had a successful medical practice in Rennes. His mother died in 1823. Simon was unable to be at her deathbed, but he returned to Rennes in 1824 to help arrange matters related to her estate. Madame Brute had been a decisive and profound influence in the religious and spiritual development of her priest son. She had never wanted him to enter religious life, but eventually she was resigned to God's will, and she supported Simon with her letters and prayers. Simon's trip to France in 1815 was for two other purposes as well. He went to bring back his beloved library of books, which would someday be considered the most prestigious personal library in America. He needed it for teaching and as an esteemed theological consultant. Father Brute also went to France to be an advocate for Mount St. Mary College in Emmitsburg to the General Superior of the Sulpicians. Upon his return to the United States, Father Brute found himself appointed president of St. Mary College in Baltimore, an office he served from 1815 to 1818. His letters to Mother Seton during this period were absent of their usual joyful spirit. He was a lonely priest. He had few friends in Baltimore, but of historical note to us, he would visit a Dr. Chatard, the father of a future bishop of Vincennes. Apparently, Father Brute was made president of St. Mary's College because of his prestige for learning, not because of his administrative abilities. John Quincy Adams reportedly said on one occasion that Simon Brute was the most learned man in America. He was known for flashes of brilliant insight. When the bishops of the United States began to hold provincial councils, Father Brute was a strong advocate for unity in Catholic teaching and practice. He was concerned for the integrity of the faith in the fledgling Catholic Church in the United States. Not surprisingly, during the councils of Baltimore, Father Brute was a primary theological consultant. Our first bishop was an esteemed theologian and teacher, a ready confessor for those seeking God's mercy, a pastor for the poor homebound, and a spiritual companion for a canonized saint. As it turned out, Madame Brute must have died with pride in a son who lived as she had taught him. Although a large part of his assigned ministry as a Sulpician priest was seminary teaching, the future Bishop of Vincennes was very much the pastor of Emmitsburg. Simon Brute was a scholar priest who was also sought after for the ministration of the sacraments. Some of Father Brute's notes chart a day in his priestly life. They are not written in prose intended for publication, but it is important to transcribe some of these notes in order to appreciate his pastoral heart. Father Brute would rise at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning. The day began with prayer and meditation before the tabernacle. Sometimes he would be present for the mass of another priest. By 8 a.m. after breakfast, he would return to the chapel on the mount to take from there on foot through the woods the Blessed Sacrament to an elderly sick person. He would pray the rosary on the way. He administered the sacrament to the sick person and on one occasion prepared her husband for his first communion. By 9:30 in the morning, Father Brute was praying psalms and singing hymns on his way to the parish church in Emmitsburg. From there he took the sacrament to a gentleman who had been away from the church for years. He heard his confession and visited with him about his faith. By 10:45 he was back at the parish church to baptize a child. He visited with the mother, whom he said had great difficulties. After that, he visited a couple of other homebound people. At noon, when he returned to the mount, he found an elderly German woman waiting to see him. She had not been to the sacraments for 10 years because she was ill and lame. She asked for his pastoral ministry and was invited to stay for a meal. By 1:30 in the afternoon, Father Brute was back at the church in Emmitsburg to get the Blessed Sacrament, which he then carried to others who were sick. He administered the anointing of the sick to a dying person. He explained the sacrament to those present, several of whom were Protestants. At 4 in the afternoon, he went to hear the confession of another sick person. On the way back to the mount, he prayed the office, the liturgy of the hours, while on foot. And on his return, he prepared instructions to be given for the sacrament of confirmation. And now he wrote, and I quote, "Am writing down these notes, but a thousand details, thoughts, and acts not told. How wonderful the day of a priest," unquote. On the margins, he had charted the mileage he had walked, almost 30 miles. There are other notes of his about his moving pastoral concern and care for black slaves in the area. And then he wrote, and I quote, "What have I done for the house?" meaning the seminary. "Reviewed the second Latin class. Had a conversation before God with one of the young men. Latin lesson. Reviewed the third French class. Latin lesson to Guy Elder. Had a conversation with another young man who came to consult me," unquote. In another set of notes about a day's pastoral activity, one can read, and I quote, "I remember to have spoken to 62 persons, more probably, in regard to matters connected with religion and their duty. Made a short exhortation in Mass, it being St. Ignatius' Day." There are other notes of Father Brute's continued reading and study. "Saturday night the 14th, I received from Baltimore a number of the Edinburgh Review and the author Stewart Against the Eternal Generation of Jesus Christ. Sunday the 15th, already read through Stewart's book and wrote a long letter of remarks upon it to Bishop Elder. Attended to the duties of the day at Emmitsburg. In the evening, read part on the road, part at home, most of the Edinburgh Review. Monday, this day I finished the Edinburgh Review, made a dozen long notes on the article on O'Meara's journal, and 2 on the article upon Duprat's works, with some research amongst my books in regard to points in these memoranda," unquote. He also wrote that he finished a map of the ecclesiastical states for the geography class and taught the theology class and then a philosophy class. And then he went on a sick call, and as he put it, the usual happy round of a priest, prayer, meditation, mass, breviary, beads, visit to the Blessed Sacrament, etc. At the end of a set of notes, he wrote, quote, God, 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 all the day long, unquote. It was not God's plan that Father Brute should be a missionary in India, but he was a zealous missionary in the New World. He loved to provide the sacraments for his people. Even as he took care of his young seminarians, he had a special regard for the poor and the elderly. His pastoral heart must have spoken volumes to the seminarians. The life of the future Bishop of Indiana was intimately tied to that of a future canonized saint for 20 years. Father Simon Brute tended to the pastoral and spiritual care of Mother Elizabeth Ann Seton until her death on January 4, 1821. He left detailed accounts of her declining days. On October 6, 1820, he wrote, and I quote, I found this morning that she had kept fasting this night for the communion of the day, though afraid I would not give it. Though I disapproved, I could but give it. Her joy was so uncommon that when I approached, and as I placed the ciborium on the little table, she burst into tears, and sobbing aloud covered her face with her hands. Unquote. On the last day of all, he wrote, towards midnight, one of the nurses tells me, offering her a drink, she refused a moment, in hope, she said, that on the morning she might be granted one communion more. Unquote. Although Simon kept in touch in her last hours, he arrived a quarter of an hour after Elizabeth had died. Her last words were, oh, so thankful. She was buried in the wood near her convent, among other sisters who had died before her. Father Brute wrote of her, oh, such a mother, such faith and love, such a spirit of true prayer, of true humility, of true self-denial in all, of true charity to all. But mark well that even our love for one another, all in this world is vanity, except it be for God, of God, in God, for eternity. For God and eternity, all in all. And indeed to live for this, to live for heaven, is at the same time to lead the happiest life upon earth. Is it not so, O Mother? Answer from your little wood. Pray now and then for me. Close quotations. It is said that profound loneliness descended upon Father Brute at her passing. She had been his friend. He had been her spiritual director. She had been his advisor in difficult times. He wrote of her, and I quote, no soul has so forcibly excited mine to see what it is to be the priest of my God, unquote. Saint Elizabeth Seton had been a calming influence for Father Brute's restless spirit and his recurring desire to go to India or China as a missionary. Once she wrote to him, quote, your restless thoughts strike me to the soul. You make the lesson of the grace of the moment so very plain to me. I owe you perhaps my very salvation by the faults and sins it has saved me from. Yet, physician, you will not heal yourself. If our God does indeed graciously destine you for China, will he not, seeing the overflowing of your boiling heart for it, open an evident door? Now that she was gone, Father Brute had lost her calming influence. But missionary he would become, not to India, but to Indiana. Fort Vincennes was a French settlement on the Wabash River. A military post had been established there in the early 1700s, and by the middle of that century, a church had been built. During the American Revolution, George Rogers Clark had captured Vincennes, by then under British control, and named Fort Sackville. Father Pierre Gibault, a priest of the Diocese of Quebec, had been for a long time the only priest in Illinois and Indiana. It was largely owing to his influence that the people of Vincennes submitted to Colonel Clark. In time, Father Benedict Joseph Flagey replaced Father Gibault, but for only a few years. By the 1830s, Vincennes was no longer only a French settlement. Catholic settlers had migrated to Kentucky from Maryland and were beginning to drift north. With the construction of railroads, the Irish were coming from the east. Yet Vincennes was still largely a Catholic town. That could not be said of the larger Indiana-Illinois territory. At the beginning of the 1800s, there were about 5,000 people in Indiana. By the 1830s, there were an estimated 500,000. But by most estimates, there were probably less than 25,000 Catholics. Unlike Kentucky or Maryland, the Catholics were not settled in groups in one or other county. In Indiana and a large part of Illinois, which would become the Diocese of Vincennes, settlements would be found in the four corners of the territory. The missionary trail would cover a couple of hundred miles from one settlement to another. There was a predominance of French in one corner, Irish or German in another. And there was a tribe of Indians near South Bend, expecting to be removed to a western reservation. This missionary territory would become home to Father Simon Brute, the first bishop of the Diocese of Vincennes. The bishops at the Second Provincial Council of Baltimore sent to Rome the name of Father Simon Brute to become the bishop of a new diocese to be erected in Indiana and eastern Illinois, the Diocese of Vincennes. Father Brute had become a highly respected theological consultant for many of the bishops of the time, especially at the councils of Baltimore. When Simon got wind of the nomination that was sent to Rome at the end of 1832, he tried his best to convince any bishop he could that he himself should not be named a bishop. In a letter to Bishop Rosati of St. Louis, he said that he was prematurely old, at age 54, and he pleaded poor health. He wrote, "This year my health gave way so rapidly that everybody thought I was falling into decline." In fact, he may well have already contracted tuberculosis, from which he would die. He claimed that he was disabled and that he would not be able to ride a horse on the missionary trails. He claimed to be suffering from melancholy. He argued that he was a recluse. He said, "You saw me avoid all the banquets during the council. I have acquired none of the American manners, and I am incapable, after all, of acquiring them. I am always with my books in my corner in the third story, or at the sisters', he said. He protested that they and his students are accustomed to my Dutch or French English. But he said nobody asked him to preach. Having lost my teeth at an early age and having neglected myself more and more in this regard, I am incapable of speaking in public. He claimed that the main shortcoming that disqualified him from becoming a bishop was his complete lack of administrative ability. This was the tenor of the arguments Father Brute would use when in July 1834 the documents from Rome erecting the Diocese of Vincennes and naming him the first bishop arrived. He wrote to his bishop friends, Rosati, Flachet, and David, Chabras, and Purcell, all the bishops of the West. He had left the decision up to them. With one voice, they told him that he should accept, and he saw no further choice in the matter. In prayer, the bishop-elect surrendered himself to the will of God. In fact, the thought of going to the wilderness of Indiana and Illinois appealed to his missionary and pastoral heart. The new bishop had to borrow money to make his way to the 13th diocese to be established in the New World. He could not afford to pack up and send his beloved library. It would have to follow later. He had $240, which the Sisters of St. Joseph's had raised for him. That and his precious library and a gold watch he had received as a gift were his sole possessions. Later he would ask that the brass crucifix he kept in the room where he heard the confession of his beloved sisters, including that of Elizabeth Ann Seton, be sent to him. He left a farewell note to the superior who had succeeded Mother Seton. "Pray, pray for Simon," he wrote. And so he made his way down the Ohio River on a steam paddle boat. He stopped at Cincinnati and Louisville on the way. There he was reunited with his old friend and mentor, Bishop Flagey, the Bishop of Bardstown. Bishop Flagey recorded his impression of the bishop-elect. He wrote, "During these 5 days that I have been in the company of this successor of the apostles, I have nothing to do but listen, admire, and bless Providence, which attains its end by inexplicable means, which would seem to be pure folly in the eyes of the world. The somewhat singular figure of this excellent prelate, the perpetual motion of his fingers, of his hands, of his head, of his entire body, while he converses, the English with an entirely French pronunciation, coming from a large toothless mouth, would seem to render him entirely useless for the post to which he has been assigned, not to say laughable or ridiculous. But, mon Dieu, when he celebrates Holy Mass, when he speaks of Jesus Christ, of his love for men, my heart dilates and is inflamed like that of the disciples of Emmaus. I am beside myself. I then hope against hope, and I anticipate miracle upon miracle that will be wrought by the venerable apostle. Through the ages, the Church has learned that with God all things are possible. The bishop-elect and his friend Bishop Flagey set out for St. Louis, where Simon was to be consecrated by Bishop Rosati. They traveled by land this time, because the new bishop of Vincennes, Simon Brute, wanted to see his sea city along the way. On October 28, 1834, the feast day of the Apostles Simon and Jude, Bishop Simon Brute was consecrated in St. Louis by Bishop Joseph Rossati. He had wanted to be consecrated on the Feast of the Holy Rosary because of his devotion to the Blessed Mother, but the time was too short for preparation. Bishop John Baptist Purcell of Cincinnati preached for the occasion. He chose for his text, "Simon, do you love me more than these?" The gospel of the Mass was, "The servant is no greater than his master." The next day, Bishop Brute issued a pastoral letter to his people. Bishop Purcell had had it printed for him. He wrote, "Unworthy as I am of so great an honor, and of myself unequal to the charge, my only trust is in God, and therefore earnestly calling for your prayers, that I may obtain his divine assistance, I come to be your chief pastor." He placed his cathedral under the patronage of St. Francis Xavier, patron of missionaries, and he placed his diocese under the patronage of Our Lady, towards whom he wrote, "It was in all ages the spirit of the Church that all Christians should entertain the most tender devotion." Bishop Brute arrived in Vincennes a week later. He was installed immediately by his elderly friend, Bishop Flaget of Bardstown, who had been a missionary in Vincennes 46 years before. In a letter to an Austrian charitable foundation, Bishop Brute described his cathedral. "The cathedral church, a plain brick building 115 feet long and 60 broad, consisting of the four walls and roof, unplastered, not even whitewashed, no sanctuary, not even a place for preserving the vestments and sacred vessels, only a simple altar of wood with a neatly gilded tabernacle, and a cross, and six beautiful candlesticks, a gift from France, which were much in contrast with the poverty and utter destitution of the place. The house built for the missionary and now the episcopal residence consists of a small, comfortable room and closet, 25 feet by 12, without, however, a cellar under or a garret above. A small plot for a garden lays between the church, on the other side of which is the Catholic cemetery. Nearby was a stable ready for the bishop's horse, when he's able to get one," he said. Bishop Brute described in detail the circumstances of his cathedral in order to illustrate the poverty of his new diocese and its urgent need for help in attending to the basic necessities. He pleaded for funding in order to be able to educate young priests and to build up those institutions of charity for orphans or others, without which, he said, religion can never be firmly established. There were an estimated 25,000 Catholics in the new diocese, and they were spread out in the four corners of the territory. Only two priests belonged to the diocese. Another priest in the Chicago area was on loan from the Diocese of St. Louis. In the beginning, the bishop's ministry was mostly focused on Vincennes. He wrote that the people were mostly of French descent, poor, illiterate, but of that open, lively disposition which speaks of their origin. They retain their faith, love their priests, but are negligent in attending to their religious duties. He said they are very remiss also in teaching their children their prayers and the catechism, and this causes them to forget it themselves. The new bishop was not well received in some quarters. A minister sent in an article to a Protestant newspaper. He wrote, You are probably aware that the Pope had constituted recently all this rich, neglected country into a diocese with Vincennes as its designated seat. Yea, the man of sin has already established himself there, and the mystery of iniquity is beginning to work in a fearful manner. The newly consecrated bishop has just arrived with two priests and taken undisputed possession of the now most important town in the state. A man from Evansville who had read about the man of sin arrived in Vincennes and announced that he came to see for himself. The man of sin, you mean me? Bishop Brute asked. Yes, sir, I mean you. They told me that I could see you in all your infernalia. You mean paraphernalia, I suppose, the bishop said. Well, come inside and I'll see what I can do for you. The bishop put on his pectoral cross, a cope and mitre, and held his crozier for the man to see. There, he said, now you've seen the man of sin. You can go home and tell the people of Evansville about it. From this primitive setting, in 5 short years, the undaunted Bishop Brute would establish his diocese on a solid footing. This is Radio 44 to be aired August 20th and 21st. Bishop Simon Brute embraced the life of a missionary with the zeal of youth, despite serious illness. He was no longer restless about becoming a missionary in India. Under the patronage of the missionary to India, St. Francis Xavier, he rode the missionary trails of Indiana. I remount my horse and trot, the rain driving in my face and cold as January. It is the old story for me. When I came to the mountain in 1811, and the daily bread of missionaries. A week after his installation as Bishop of Vincennes, Simon decided to visit his entire diocese. Clearly, two priests to assist in the ministry of the diocese would not do, and so he wrote to the bishop of his native diocese of Rennes to see if he could find help. He also wrote to his younger brother Augustine, seeking everything from cruets for mass, vestments, altar cards, missals, a ring and a pectoral cross, in case I lose mine, he said, a mitre, a crozier, the one I have is gilded wood, to a very light chasuble for carrying on horseback. He drew a map of the diocese for his brother, a copy of which still exists. The majority of the people encountered in the diocese were not Catholic, but for the most part suspicions were laid aside, and the bishop and his two priests were received kindly. Bishop Brute wrote, "The bishop left every place well pleased, fondly believing that the people would easily be reconciled to the man of sin of Vincennes, and more easily to the other sinners, his successors." The bishop's lot was like that of any other missionary at the time. He had to inquire where a Catholic family might be found and go in search of them. Most Catholics didn't even know that Indiana had its own bishop until he arrived. Their bishop rode hundreds of miles on horseback. He wrote to a friend in May of 1835 that he had made his rounds with an ease that I could express, if to be believed, by saying that I felt no more tired every evening than if I had not left my room. I can't conceive it. One day it was full 60 miles till 11 o'clock at night, mostly through the wet prairies. But there wasn't much the bishop could do for his scattered people until he found more priests. He knew that he could only find them in France. And so in July 1835 he left for Paris. There the bishop from the wilderness won many hearts. His zeal and sanctity attracted priests and seminarians as recruits. His appeal to heroism touched their natural inclination to nobility of heart and spirit. It is said that people in the seminary were pulling out threads of the bishop's worn cassock to keep as the relic of a saint. A dozen seminarians and eight priests were to return with him to America. A few others needed first to complete their studies and priestly formation. Bishop Brute was not surprised to meet resistance from the parents of the priests and seminarians, much like that of his own mother. He wrote to one mother, "There are in yonder America souls waiting the generosity of a mother whom the Lord will know full well how to console in the loneliness of her last moments." The bishop also sought German-speaking missionaries because Germans were flocking into his diocese. 20 clerics sailed back to America with the saintly bishop. Two of them would become the second and the third bishop of Vincennes. This voyage across the Atlantic was particularly perilous. At one point, the whole group was on their knees asking the bishop for absolution because they feared shipwreck. Bishop Brute said, "Do not fear, my children. Fear is one of the devil's great deceits. We shall not perish." On the better days at sea, Bishop Brute gave the group conferences preparing them to be missionaries in the wilderness. Once home in Indiana, the bishop was able to convince Mother Rose White in Emmitsburg to send three sisters to join two Sisters of Charity of Nazareth, Kentucky, to help educate children in the Diocese of Vincennes. In 1837, 13 diocesan priests, 5 deacons, and 2 subdeacons were organized in missionary fashion as circuit riders and pastors of strategic parishes. The bishop was not without the heartache caused by a couple of less than faithful priests, but these were the exception. By the time of his death in 1839, there would be 25 diocesan priests and 20 seminarians serving an expanding population. Fear is one of the devil's great deceits. What a great quote. The holiness of our founding bishop, his own heroism, and his appeal to the nobility of his people and clergy laid the foundation for Catholicism in Indiana. Bishop Benedict Joseph Flaget of Bardstown said, "An American missionary had to be able to live on nothing and cook it for himself." When Father Simon Brute first came to America as a seminary teacher and missionary at the Mount in Emmitsburg, he was entitled to a salary of $50 a year, which he rarely collected because of his desire to live a simple life. At times he gave some of what little clothes he owned to the poor. Once he gave his coat to a beggar. He would borrow ill-fitting clothes from the seminarians. The small sums of money received from his mother or his brother were not kept for himself. To save money, he would walk to Baltimore rather than take the stagecoach. In 1839, when he died as the Bishop of Vincennes, he was buried in borrowed clothes. Because of his simplicity, Bishop Simon Brute, although a highly educated priest from France, was called the silent power of the church in its infancy in the United States. He was praised in those words because of his missionary vision and his love for the larger church. He was respected for his prudence and admired for his holiness. With the eyes of faith, he was a man of hope. Bear in mind that when he began as Bishop of Indiana and half of Illinois, including Chicago, he had three priests to help him in truly trying circumstances. Yet he could write to a bishop friend, "Generally my troubles are more on the surface, and there is peace in the depth of my heart, where dwells a pure and simple abandonment to God alone." The restless longing for the missions in India faded with his arrival in Indiana. Bishop Routet's spirit of hope in the wilderness and his ability to abandon himself to God's will was rooted in the spiritual depth of prayer. He had been the spiritual director for St. Elizabeth Ann Seton for many years. Once he wrote to her, "Pray, pray, pray continually for the church, especially in America, and for this diocese." When he was named Bishop of Vincennes, he wrote to the superior who succeeded her, "Pray, pray for Simon." His exhortation to pray echoes down the years. No pastoral ministry was too difficult. One bitter winter night, Bishop Routet was called to attend to a dying man who lived several miles from Vincennes. After walking a short distance through deep snow, his guide began to complain and then finally refused to go any farther because his feet were freezing. Bishop Routet, who was saying his rosary, said to the man, "Walk in my footsteps." So the man did, and all was well. "Follow the footsteps of Bishop Routet" is still a cogent invitation to those times when we might be called to trudge through deep snow in what may seem to be a dark night. Before becoming our first bishop, Father Brute was best known as a seminary professor and president of Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg, Maryland. History records his deep concern for the effective teaching and the integrity of the Catholic faith in a pioneer milieu in which the church was finding her way. His concern and his theological expertise were appreciated by the first bishops of the church in America. He was their preeminent theologian. Concern for the purity of doctrine of our faith is a worthy heritage received from our founding bishop. Bishop Routet went on foot in deep snow to bring God's love and mercy to a dying man. Throughout his life, he was sought as a spiritual director and confessor. His witness, even as he himself was being consumed by tuberculosis, inspires us to hunger for the sacraments and holiness, whether convenient or inconvenient. When Bishop Routet died, one of his priests wrote, "Bishop Routet set the example of the most brotherly affection. When he was with us, we did not feel our weariness. Nothing was hard to us, and we scarcely knew we were poor, although deprived of almost every necessity of life." It is of the essence of being members of the body of Christ that, like Bishop Routet, we can be with each other so that nothing seems hard and the feeling of weariness is lifted. Bishop Routet was humbled whenever he presided and preached at Mass. Despite his brilliance and education, he was unable to master the English language. It was difficult to understand him, and he was embarrassed, because in the primitive circumstances of his time, he had lost all of his teeth. Yet, we can look at his priestly life and see what God can do. Our founding bishop carried on with faith and hope. How grateful we are as beneficiaries of the rest of the story. In 1834, seven Catholic churches were served in the expansive Diocese of Vincennes by Bishop Simon Brute and three other priests. Mass in several other venues was occasional. By the time the bishop died in June of 1839, only 5 years later, the sacraments were being celebrated in 27 parish churches, and four more were being built. Masses were also celebrated in 30 other stations. There were 25 priests and 20 seminarians. Two religious communities had been founded. There was a college for young men and an academy for young women. Elementary schools enrolled 130 students. The phenomenal development under the leadership of our founding bishop testifies to the power of God's grace working through a holy missionary. Simon had written to his brother Augustine, "My health is failing fast, my days are vanishing, but every day my heart experiences great joy at the unremitting progress of the church. Although I should like to remain a little longer, I am resigned to the Master's will." Father John McCaffrey, president of Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg, a good friend of Bishop Brute, left a splendid testimony about the nobility of the bishop's last days. He wrote, "Difficulties that would have disheartened almost anyone else only served to increase his zeal and charity. Having commenced a journey of 400 miles in such a state of bodily suffering that he could not sit upright on his horse, he nevertheless completed it without the intermission of a single day. Shortly before his death, he left Vincennes to visit a distant mission, and though so weak and extenuated that he could scarcely support his tottering frame, in the absence of the pastor, he attended to three distant sick calls on the same day, and almost dying, administered the consolations of religion to those who appeared no nearer mortal disillusion than himself. Death, which could be no unwelcome visitor to one whose thoughts, hopes, and affections all centered in a better world, found him full-handed of good works, and longing only to be dissolved and to be with Christ. Invincibly patient and brightly and resigned under the severest suffering, full of tender piety, calm, collected, and exhibiting his characteristic virtues to the last, he set a beautiful example of the manner in which a Christian should prepare himself to run his final race and to win the glorious immortality. As his strength diminished, his devotion increased. He sought no alleviation for his sufferings. On the contrary, he was eager still to labor and endure in the twofold view of doing good to others and resembling more his crucified Savior. When unable to walk or stand, he would at least sit up and write to any whom he could hope to benefit by his correspondence. And to those around him he would speak on pious subjects, such as the love of God, conformity to his holy will, or devotion to the Blessed Virgin with the unction of a saint and the ardor of a seraph. These last precious days of his life were thus entirely taken up in the works of charity, in instructing, edifying, and consoling those who were with him, and in intimate and affectionate communion with his God, whom he hoped soon to see face to face and love and enjoy forever. He preferred often to be left alone, that he might the more freely indulge his pious feelings, and for this end he would allow no one to watch by him by night until his mortal agony had begun. The will of God be done was the constant language of his lips, as it was the abiding sentiment of his heart. After having received the last sacrament, he directed the departing prayers to be recited, which he answered devoutly and fervently until the last. And then on the morning of the 26th of June at 1:30, he calmly and sweetly surrendered his soul into the hands of his Creator. Bishop Brute's last words were those of Christ, "Sitio, I thirst." As we reflect on the last days of our founding bishop in this year 2005, we cannot help but think of the last days of our recently deceased Pope John Paul II. The similarities are striking. Their witness of charity and humility as infirm pastors dedicated to their people to the very end is touching. As for the late Holy Father, so for our first bishop, all with one accord mourned for the scholar, the philanthropist, and the saint. Crowds of persons of every rank and of all denominations visited his corpse and assisted at the ceremonies of his burial. It is said that the whole population poured forth to accompany, in solemn silence, the honored remains of the holy and unlikely bishop, the first bishop of Vincennes, to their lasting resting place. This week I conclude my summer presentation on the life of our first bishop, Simon Gabriel Brute. My admiration for Bishop Brute can be traced back to my early years as a seminarian. One time with some seminarian friends from Jasper, I visited the old cathedral in Vincennes. I was intrigued by our early roots and by the courage and zeal of our first bishop. He was able to do so much with so little human and financial resources, and he did so much in such a brief time. He was Bishop of Vincennes only 5 years before he died. Later, I would become more aware of his personal holiness. I had also done some study of the first pastors of St. Joseph's Parish in my hometown of Jasper. Those studies led me back to our first bishop. Never did I dream I would be in a position to promote the cause for his canonization. After visiting his tomb in Vincennes in August of 2003, I asked Monsignor Fred Easton to serve as my liaison in moving the possible cause of canonization of Bishop Brute forward. Monsignor Easton, our vicar judicial, is an expert in canon law, and he is familiar with the canonical process involved. He has been actively involved in the cause of Blessed Mother Theodore Guerin. He sent a copy of Sister Godecker's extensive biography of our first bishop to Dr. Andrea Ambrosi in Rome, who had served as the postulator for Mother Theodore's cause. Dr. Ambrosi is of the opinion that Bishop Brute's life is a possible case for canonization. After a subsequent personal meeting with Dr. Ambrosi, I decided to consult the bishops of Indiana, some lay advisors, and priests about the wisdom of pursuing the cause. Having received an affirmative response from all parties, I have named Dr. Ambrosi as postulator to guide us through the initial procedures of pursuing Bishop Brute's possible canonization. I chose Dr. Ambrosi because of his involvement in the cause of Blessed Mother Theodore and his familiarity with the Church in its early years in Indiana. Father Paul Aitchen, who has a deep appreciation for our first bishop, has been named vice postulator. At my request, Monsignor Easton has put together the required historical commission, which will pursue the collection and investigation of papers and relevant materials pertaining to the life and ministry of Bishop Brute. The formal canonical opening session of the investigation will take place September 12th in the presence of the postulator and vice postulator. It is the first required step in the investigation. The fact that Bishop Brute was esteemed as a holy person was strikingly affirmed by the renowned James Cardinal Gibbons during a visit to Vincennes on December 4, 1891. He said, and I quote, "Worthy citizens of Vincennes, you need not go on pilgrimage to visit the tombs of the saints. There is one reposing here in your midst, namely the saintly founder of this diocese, Right Reverend Simon Brute." Close quotations. The apostolic zeal, humility, simplicity, determination, courage, and confidence in God's will make Bishop Brute a splendid model for all Catholics of our day. He is a relevant model for all who are involved in furthering the ministry of the Church. He was arguably the most influential theologian of the Church in the United States in his day. His commitment to faithful prayer and his deep love for the Holy Eucharist highlighted his generous ministry to his people. His way of life provides an outstanding model, not only for our priests and seminarians, but also for those preparing to become deacons and lay ministers. Indeed, the holiness of Bishop Brute is a wonderful example and inspiration for all lay people and religious women and men. I'm pleased that the official cause of Bishop Brute will be inaugurated this month. From now on, we will count on his intercession and God's will for further developments. When I prayed at the tomb of Bishop Brute 2 years ago, I put the outcome of all this in his hands. I suspect as well that St. Elizabeth Ann Seton will be interceding for her former spiritual director and confessor. I do not expect this process to be completed during my tenure as Archbishop of Indianapolis, but I feel I'm doing my duty by launching the investigative process. A year ago, I placed our college seminary house of formation at Marian College under the patronage of Bishop Brute because of his holiness and his love for priestly formation. I encourage us to promote public knowledge about our holy first bishop and to spread the word about his cause for canonization. Bishop Brute is a worthy intercessor for healing and for our own holiness. Learning about his life also tells us and our children much about the founding of the Church in Indiana.